1990 to 1996, a series of articles were published in the LGBT and mainstream journals advocating for marriage of same-sex couples to become a national priority in LGBT organizing. 1993, Hawaii Supreme Court rules that prohibiting same-sex couples from marrying may violate Hawaii Constitution's ban on sex discrimination and can only be upheld if prohibition is justified by a compelling reason. In 1996, no compelling reason is found. 1994, language in the California Civil Code defines a marriage between a man and a woman. February 2004, a week after the Massachusetts Supreme Court rules marriage cannot be limited to opposite-sex couples, San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom instructs City Hall to issue licenses to same-sex couples, igniting a rush to altars in the city. August 2004, the California High Court voids the 4,000 same-sex marriage licenses issued in San Francisco because state law defines marriage as between a man and a woman. April 2005, a San Francisco judge voids the state law against gay marriage. October 2006, the San Francisco judge's decision was overturned on appeal. December 2006, the California Supreme Court agrees to hear the case. May 2008, in a 4-3 vote, Supreme Court justices overturn a 2000 ban on same-sex marriage. June 2008, a constitutional amendment defining marriage in California as between a man and a woman garners over 1 million signatures, qualifying for the November 4th ballot only days before gay and lesbian marriages commence across the state. November 4th, 2008. Proposition 8 passes with 52% of voters casting ballots in favor of the measure and 48% voting against it. Anger over the proposition's narrow victory translates into vigils and protests against the proposed constitutional amendment across the state and across the nation, as supporters of same-sex marriage vow to continue their fight.
For the third straight day, thousands marched in California protesting the election night passage of Proposition 8, banning same-sex marriage.
Hopefully it'll carry on into the future and this thing will get repealed.
Crowds continued to target the Mormons promoting the same-sex marriage ban and encouraged members to cross state lines to join the campaign. Governor Arnold
Tell us about the rally that happened on Saturday here in Portland, Oregon.
This last Saturday, Portland, Oregon, we organized a rally here at Portland State University at the South Park Blocks. And not only was it in Portland, Oregon, there was a few other locations, Eugene and I believe Bend, Oregon. But these rallies were located across the nation.
I share your frustration. I share your anger. I share your hurt.
This is not a religious issue. This is a human rights issue.
Proposition 8 was passed this November in California. It changed the state constitution to restrict the definition of marriage to a union between a man and a woman and eliminated the right of same-sex couples to marry. Proposition 8 passed with 52.3% of the vote. Some blame for the loss of Prop 8 was initially placed on people of color. A small sample exit poll showed that black voters cited 70% in favor of the measure. Also, black turnout, speculated to have been spurred by the Barack Obama presidential campaign, was unusually high, making up roughly 10% of those polled. Critics objected to media accounts that uncritically report this data as placing undue responsibility for the passage of Proposition 8 on black voters. Tonight on Circle A Radio, we explore the issues of marriage equality, people of color, and the LGBT movement. First, we talk with Thomas Wheatley, organizing director of Basic Rights Oregon, about the political implications of Prop 8 and how his organization participated in elections across Oregon and supported the fight against Proposition 8 in California. We then talk to Bonnie Tinker and Reverend Cecil Prescott from Love Makes a Family about multicultural and cross-issue community organizing. Stay tuned.
Thank you. My name is Thomas Wheatley. I'm the organizing director at Basic Rights Oregon. We are a statewide political grassroots advocacy organization dedicated to ending discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And I work with our team around the state to engage voters, volunteers, and activists in making change in the community.
As an organizer in Oregon, how closely were you involved in California's Prop 8 campaign?
Basic Rights Oregon was actively involved in the No on 8 campaign as a statewide organization dedicated to achieving marriage equality here in Oregon and around the country. We organized volunteers in Portland and in Eugene to work on phone banks to talk to California voters about the measure. We reached out to friends and family who live in California to make sure they were going to vote no on 8. And then we actually raised about $10,000 for the campaign. So we were pretty active in the effort to try to beat this discriminatory measure. You know, I think the experience in California has a lot of similarities to Oregon's 2004 vote on ballot measure 36, which amended Oregon's constitution to add discrimination into the constitution by limiting marriage to one man and one woman. In the case of Oregon, people had been legally married for a short period of time in Multnomah County in 2004, which only, you know, gave us an opportunity to educate the public about this critically important life experience for same-sex couples, Karen and committed couples, and also added a little bit of fuel to the fire of the opposition, which ultimately passed Measure 36 and wrote discrimination into the Oregon Constitution in 2004, and we're still kind of living under the sting of that discrimination here now in Oregon.
In the media, we saw a lot of blaming of people of color for the passage of Prop 8. Can we hear your analysis around that and why you think Prop 8 passed?
Well, you know, I don't have a whole lot of detail of why the measure itself passed. I do know that the blame game is primarily being moved as a message by the right wing. I mean, it's Tony Perkins, the head of the Family Research Council, one of the largest anti-gay, anti-choice groups in the country, who goes on Bill O'Reilly and talks about how people of color voted for Prop 8. There are, unfortunately, some LGBT folks who are really hurt. You know, this is a blow for anyone who believes in the values of equality and inclusion, and people end up struggling with that that pain, and it's really difficult to reconcile that painful loss with the historic election of Barack Obama. But, you know, I think the original figure that was quoted in a lot of the media that claims that 7 of 10 African-American voters voted yes on 8 is actually inaccurate. I mean, that was based on a very small sample in a poll done right after, an exit poll done right after the election. One of the political poll gurus that folks out there might be paying attention to, Nate Silver, who blogs at 538.com, has analyzed that data and indicated that, in fact, the Obama surge in California contributed positively for our side on the no on 8, meaning young voters, new voters, first-time voters voted against Prop 8. They voted in favor of marriage equality by a 62-38 margin. Young Latino voters, age 18-29, voted against Prop 8. They voted in favor of marriage equality by 59-41. And I really believe, and I think we all, when we look at the data that's being circulated by the right wing about the African-American vote, that it's actually really inaccurate. So it's unfortunate that folks are engaged in this blame game, because the truth is that pro-equality voters in California came from all walks of life, communities of color, faith leaders, labor and business leaders, Republicans, as well as Democrats and independents voted against Measure 8. And, you know, we should not forget that 8 years ago, California passed a marriage ban by a 22% margin. And this year, they passed the same ban by a 4% margin. Now, that's not victory, but that is historic progress that should not be forgotten.
And it seems like a lot of this blaming just comes from this mentality of kind of divide and conquer. And I wonder if you could talk about some of the efforts that you saw during this campaign and during the No on 36 campaign about different focused communities and social movements working together.
I wish I could say that our side, the No on 36 campaign in 2004, which was the 2004 marriage equality campaign in Oregon, I wish I could say our side did a tremendous job of engaging all communities in Oregon, and particularly of having a meaningful dialogue early on and engagement within communities of color. But I don't know that that's completely true. I don't know that we really did the work that we needed to do in 2004 to engage voters of color in meaningful dialogue around marriage equality. I do know that Basic Rights Oregon has invested significantly in building cross-racial alliances, because we know that only by building alliances between the LGBT community and communities of color, and by prioritizing the struggles and experiences of gay and transgender people of color, gay and transgender immigrants, gay and transgender low-income people, are we really going to build a strong enough unified movement for equality for everyone. We all know what it's like to be under attack. We know what it's like to be backed into a corner. We know what it's like to spend hundreds of millions of dollars just to defend what we've got. Whether somebody is a straight ally or a person of color or an LGBT person or an LGBT person of color, we all know that when the far right attacks, it impacts all of us. And I think that's one of the reasons why Basic Rights Oregon is really committed to being a good ally. We spent a ton of time and energy this election cycle here in Oregon trying to beat back two local anti-immigrant ballot measures, because immigrants and LGBT people know what it's like to live under laws that treat them as less than human. And that's one of the reasons why we're trying to build these alliances for the long haul. You know, a ballot measure campaign is a tornado of activity that takes place over about 100 days. It's not in that 100 days that you're going to build those multiracial coalitions and alliances. It's in the non-election years, and that's what we're trying to do here in Oregon.
Can you talk a little bit more specifically about what your role was in trying to defeat those anti-immigrant ballot measures here in Oregon and Columbia County, and what the result of that was?
In Columbia County in the summer, a lone right-wing activist qualified two local anti-immigrant ballot measures, measures 5190 and 5191. And one of these would require businesses caught hiring undocumented workers to pay a $10,000 fine. And the other requires construction sites to post oversized 4-foot by 8-foot signs outside of any construction site saying legal workers only, and including the phone number for the Department of Homeland Security and the Sheriff's Office, really kind of an intimidation tactic designed to single out anybody who doesn't look white. Basic Rights Oregon joined a team of organizations led by CAUSA, the Statewide Immigrant Rights Coalition, and Rural Organizing Project, which organizes in rural communities to support democracy and equality, to fight back against these measures. And together we ran a pretty significant campaign. You know, we raised and spent about $70,000. We placed 30,000 phone calls. We sent 60 or 70,000 pieces of mail and ran a significant campaign. We won one of the ballot measures and we lost the other. So one that did pass, the $10,000 fine on businesses, is likely to go to the courts as to be litigated. But, you know, honestly, it was an opportunity for progressive Oregonians to stand together and to engage rural voters who are too often put in a position of being asked to vote against immigrant rights or vote against gay rights in order to protect something else, this some, you know, meaningless idea that somebody's kind of shoving down their throats. So it's an exciting campaign. You know, we're excited to have beaten one of them. We're very disappointed that Measure 5190 passed, but we think we did a little bit of work to try to prevent the anti-immigrant crowd from moving the ball down the field.
And what kind of response did you get to that work from within the GLBTQ community?
We got a great response. We had phone banks running in several parts of the state every week for the last 10 weeks of the election, and everywhere we went, there were queer Oregonians standing up for basic rights for themselves and for their friends and families in the immigrant community. I mean, I think LGBT Oregonians understand, after the last 20 years of anti-immigrant ballot measures, what it's like to be under attack, and folks really understand that if, you know, there's a James Baldwin quote that we talk about sometimes. He said, in a letter to Angela Davis, if they come for you in the morning, they will be coming for us that night. And I think that's really rings true for the LGBT community and the immigrant community in terms of building alliances and watching each other's backs.
Are there any other projects in the pipeline that you'd like to tell our listeners about?
Certainly, we'll be looking in 2009 and forward to launching a campaign to repeal Measure 36 in a future election and take discrimination out of our own constitution and then move forward to win marriage equality in Oregon. It's a kind of campaign that will require each and every one of us to step up and commit ourselves to being the change that we want to see in the world, to talking to our friends, families, and neighbors about these issues, and to suspending our assumptions. I mean, I think folks in the white LGBT community around the country historically have not done nearly enough work to engage communities of color and to open up space for the leadership of people of color in this movement. And I think it's incumbent on us to walk that path together. We're also, you know, looking to strengthen Oregon statutes regarding bullying and making our schools safer for kids who are a little different, whether those are gay kids or transgender kids or kids with accents or kids with disabilities or so forth. So that's something we're really excited about as well.
Do you want to let our listeners know how they can get involved?
There is always more work to be done. We love folks to get involved. The only way we get this work done is by having members of the community engaged, straight, gay, transgender, from all walks of life. So you can give us a ring at the office at 503-222-6151. That's 503-222-6151. Or you can find us online and sign up at www.basicrights.org.
Thank you so much.
That was Thomas Wheatley from Basic Rights, Oregon.
You're listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO 90.7 in Portland. Tonight we're talking about the struggle for marriage equality. Next up, you'll hear from Bonnie Tinker and Cecil Prescott of Love Makes a Family.
My name is Cecil Charles Prescott, and I'm on the board of Love Makes a Family.
And I'm Bonnie Tinker, and I'm the executive director of Love Makes a Family and the founder. Love Makes a Family is an organization of lesbian, gay, bi, and trans-headed families and our friends. And we educate and advocate for family equality, social justice, and peace. And the founding work really started way back about 1987. When I decided to make a videotape about lesbian and gay Quaker families. And we were just about ready to introduce that video to the Quaker public in 1992 when the ballot measure happened, Measure 9. And all of a sudden, instead of having a nice little discussion from Quaker meeting to Quaker meeting, we had a need for a real public voice of LGBT families. So that's our history, basically.
And would you talk a little bit, too, about Ballot Measure 9?
It seems almost as if it was another era, and indeed it was. Ballot Measure 9 was part of a movement of the religious right in organizing in the state of Oregon as well as nationwide, beginning in the late 70s, early 80s. And Ballot Measure 9 was proposed by a group called the Oregon Citizens Alliance, which was in the statute demonize, I would use the word demonize, homosexual. And I think, Bonnie, do you remember the exact words in terms of
I'm close on one of them. There were two things it was going to do, two major things. One is it was going to say that no public funds could be spent in any way that supported homosexuality or bestiality, for that matter. And I'm not sure if they actually left bestiality in the long run, but we had great fun with that. I don't know where that came from. But the other thing it said was that all public schools would set a community standard that homosexuality is unnatural, immoral, wrong, and perverse. I may have the order of those words wrong, but those are the words. And so it was really, in some ways, it wasn't going to do any more than what was actually the status quo at the time. Because schools did set that standard, and public monies were not spent to support homosexuality. But it was going to write it into the Constitution, which meant that instead of just needing to make social change, we would have had this enormous constitutional ballot to even be a part of civil society.
And part of the concern of this organization, Love Makes a Family, because early on we worked with families which were outside of mainstream. And because of our concerns for working with our family and with our children, especially in the public schools, it was a frontal attack on who we were and our communities.
Right. Well, and the rallying cry of what has now come to be called the Christian right was family values. And what we were saying is, wait a minute, we have family values. We really know something about family values because we have held our families together in the absence of all legal, social, economic, and, you know, religious support. And at that time, the LGBT community, which was actually at that point still thinking of itself as the gay community, people had survived by building very good closets. And, you know, we had very nice community within that closet. And families with children were, first of all, rarely inside there. And if they were, the children were not often seen as a real part of the community. So oftentimes, lesbian and gay people didn't even see themselves as having families. So one of the first things we had to do was to reclaim that whole territory of family and say, wait a minute, we are family.
And hence part of our name, we wanted to broaden the discussion about what constitutes family, and as part of that discussion, talk about how we are socialized, what values we share with one another, how families survive who are outside of the mainstream, what social, economic, and political needs need to be met. And so historically, we have sought to address the issue of LGBT community and people in general, but specifically asking the broader question about how do we create a more socially engaged and social just community.
Well, and a part of that was that we were very clear that oppression of, at that time, gay people, if you will, was not only a part of LGBT oppression, but that it was connected to all other forms of discrimination, so that we couldn't function in a vacuum. And very specifically, from the beginning, we looked at diversity in several areas. One was of diversity of sexual orientation. Another one was diversity of race and ethnic background. And the third real important area to us was income, because we saw all of those as integral. And I think a fourth strand that became more apparent as we went on, we came out of originally a Quaker base, which is very clearly religious, and we had other people who came in who shared that strong religious base in their life. And we also found that many families with children were, in fact, going to the churches because they were looking for safe places to build community. So that was something that really set us apart from what at that point was the mainstream gay political organizing. On every one of those counts set us apart. And I think that our approach, therefore, was not so much through businesses and political polling and political parties. Our approach was very much a person-to-person kind of, and it really was a strategy. So rather than relying on polling data, for instance, we relied on what we knew from our family, our friends, our neighbors, the people we talked to.
What is the role of religion in both contributing to homophobia and then combating it?
That's a great question. Culturally, if you look across the world, all of the fundamentalist religions have got their own version of homophobia. So that is one institutional structure that supports homophobia and heterosexism around the world. And most of the arguments that we hear against LGBT people are in fact based in what people think at least is some religious text, language, or church or congregation. The flip side of that is that the whole movement toward marriage equality, for example, actually started within faith communities, within churches. Because in this culture, although marriage conveys a lot of civil rights, it still is very much bound up in religious mythologies and cultural expectations. So again, from the beginning, Love Makes a Family was very aware of the need to organize within those faith communities, and also to be aware of, and I don't even want to call them the anti-gay faith communities. I would rather call them the anti-gay religious institutions.
We are certainly aware of the role of religion in terms of promoting homophobia, but also aware of the role it may play in resisting and overcoming homophobia. And as Bonnie shared with us, many of the early organizer and some of our own philosophical and historical backgrounds were out of the religious communities. And so therefore, we also recognize the need to talk and engage in religious communities, both because we felt that much of the political and social resistance to homophobia was based on religious forms of homophobia, as Bonnie shared with us, but also realizing that within those religious and social communities could find the strength to resist. And if you could find a way in which to confront people in a way that appealed not only to what was ugly and worse in them, but to what is best, then a true transformation could take place. So part of our strategy, but part of our way of operating was the belief that all people or social communities are based on certain fundamental principles, and that if we found the source of that which was good and true, that transformation to take place can take place within those social units in such a way that that makes the other work much easier. So in terms of a long-term battle, we recognize that, you know, polling and identifying likely voters are very important. But we also realize that social transformation begins and is strengthened by the transformation that takes place within individuals and within communities. And so that we found it necessary to also seek what was promising and helpful in those religious community to overcome homophobia.
You are listening to an interview with Bonnie Tinker and Cecil Prescott from Love Makes a Family here on Circle A Radio, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
Marriage is really about love, and it's also about being a grown-up. We don't have any coming-of-age ritual in this society. In many ways, marriage has served as that coming-of-age ritual for generations. So if you're not allowed to marry, you're not really allowed to join the community of adults. That's very important to people. The other one is the rights. And while the fact is that most people don't get married because of the rights, I mean, how many people say, honey, I think, will you marry me? I want to share our health care benefits, right? That's not really what's going on. On the other hand, there are a whole slew of rights. I mean, there are like 500 state ones and 1,500 federal rights and responsibilities that are tied up in law using the word marriage. And the way I look at it is, you know, we all have learned that it's not the same thing to be one minority as to be another minority. And I think one of the reasons is that the mechanisms of discrimination that are used against different minorities are different. And one of the primary mechanisms of discriminating against LGBT people is to exclude them from the family, both literally their birth family and legally from all of those protections of family. And marriage is the key institution. So if we want to be equal in this society, we have to be able to marry. I often say, we paid the gay tax all the time we were raising our children. And people say, gay tax? What gay tax? So, it's very simple. Sarah and I had three children, but we could never apply for health insurance as a family. We paid for two sets of family health insurance every month. That was a tax on our family that diminished what we could give to our children. It increased our worries if any of our children were sick. It's just one of those little things that other people take for granted, and we didn't get it, and we paid for it. There's a financial implication that comes with rights.
Related to that, I was really interested to look at the beyondmarriage.org that talks about this strategic vision, and it went into a lot of other types of family that aren't recognized. Mm-hmm. So if you could talk a little bit about that strategic vision.
We need not to just talk about gay marriage or marriage equality for lesbian and gay people. We do need that. But what we really should be looking at is access to marriage, because there are many people, including many opposite sex couples, who practically speaking really cannot access all of the legal and financial benefits of marriage. A few quick examples. Now that divorce is possible, what is happening is you've got a lot of middle-aged parents divorcing, and then they go off and fall in love again. I'm talking about opposite sex parents. And at that point, they've got kids who are in college. If they remarry, their new spouse's income is used as a basis for whether the children get financial aid. So there are many prominent middle-class people who are not remarrying in middle age because it will so severely impact their children's education. You also have people on various kinds of pensions or government benefits. And we've heard a lot about senior citizens. Sometimes if they remarry, they lose pension benefits, or with Social Security, if they're married, or disability benefits, if you're married, you get actually a lower amount than two single individuals get. So those folks, practically speaking, can't marry. And I first really realized this when we have a niece and a nephew, her husband now, who are special needs people, and they wanted to get married. And they told us, but we can't get married because they wouldn't be able to live on what they would get in benefits if they were legally married. And we said, heck, we know how to do this. We're lesbians. You don't have to have a legal marriage to have a marriage. What matters is between the two of you. And we put together a wedding for them. They had a marriage. They consider themselves totally married, but they can't access any of those legal benefits because they can't afford to.
Cecil Prescott from Love Makes a Family.
I think it's important to remember as we talk about this movement that is so prominent today about marriage equality, to recognize its history and also to challenge its future. I think someone like Bonnie, who before it was popular in mainstream LGBT communities or organizations, was advocating for marriage equality. So, for years, Love Makes a Family had an annual event, Freedom to Marry. Early on was part of, started a Freedom to Marry coalition here in Oregon. And so before the mainstream organization heard of marriage, we advocated for it, and in fact was criticized for it to some degree. But we also recognized early on that it was more than talking about marriage, because marriage, as Bonnie reminds us, affords people access into society. But if that's all we want, we're going to leave out many, many peoples and many, many communities. And also because we think we need to hold a more critical eye to society as it is. And so what the Beyond Marriage document does in part is speak to mainstream organizations who are carrying the banner very loudly for marriage equality and saying, this is a very important thing, but it's not the whole pie. And in fact, we need to begin to criticize our society and standards in our society. In fact, in a very strange way, to return back to the roots of what was then the gay liberation movement in terms of being very radical and countercultural. And so the Beyond Marriage document does, in part, is not only speak of a vision of a new society, but also ask those who are in the forefront of marriage equality today to think more critically and to be more inclusive of your vision of what a socially just society is like.
How did media coverage of Proposition 8 affect the reaction to its outcome?
Well, the media coverage went right to polls, and they wanted to find out what percentage of who voted how. And they did small samples, and they came up with numbers. And we can, you can always say about a poll, well, they're wrong. So they might have been wrong. But what's interesting is the way people responded to that information. Because the way the information came out is this percentage of African Americans voted for it, this percentage of Hispanics voted for it, this percentage of rural people voted for it. And therefore, these were the bad guys. So the first thing to look at is the people who responded immediately, these guys are the bad guys. Why did that happen? Why was it so easy for, and I have seen, you know, urban white lesbians go immediately to look what the African American community did to us, when in fact, one of those people had a parent, a white urban middle class parent in California who voted for Proposition 8. And I think the missing ingredient here is, again, going back to the religious institutions. So let's, if you look at a segment of society based on how tied they are and how influenced they are by religious institutions who are fundamentally fundamentalists, who are evangelical, you will find higher proportions of those people voted to support Proposition 8. And what happened is, as I said before, these fundamentalists organize across all lines. I remember going to a panel at the Women's Conference in China on the family, and they had about 5 different languages they were translating in. They had every religion present represented, and they all came out with the same James Dobson Focus on the Family line. So if those folks got together and saw that there were churches in rural areas, there were churches in African-American communities, Hispanic communities still strongly influenced by the Catholic Church, they went for them. They organized them. So what I would say, if anything, this is a reflection on our own organizing strategy. And I think that where we have fallen down is two areas. First of all, it has now come to the attention of the LGBT political movement that, quote, communities of faith are important. But it has not yet entirely come to their attention that therefore they should accept direction from LGBT people of faith who are in those religious communities and who have years of experience organizing there. And I would guess that some of the same thing happened in other communities, where the folks who had the polling numbers and all the right answers and all the right sound bites went in and told people how to do it. And this is one where we've been told you can't win rights through a popular vote. We have a slight difficulty here that in Oregon, for instance, we've now got a constitutional amendment, and it doesn't look like the Supreme Court's going to undo that for us. So we are going to have to actually have a cultural shift. And you can't do that without doing business in a new way, connecting with new ways with across the board with everybody.
I've only seen some of the media coverage around Prop 8 in California, but something that has occurred to me as I reviewed some of the material is how quickly we go to a very, very ugly place. In terms of placing blame and critique and helping to promote divisiveness in various communities. I'm African American, and I saw the reaction to Prop 8 as very offensive in terms of stereotyping. But also it occurred to me that this is business as usual, that the larger LGBT community saw people of color as very marginalized in its outlook, in its thinking, in its organizing. And therefore, I suppose, did not place critical dollars and people and person with community ties in decisions of leaderships. Therefore, I am not surprised that there needs to be continued work in my community. At the same time, the racism that has come out reminds me how easy it is for people to say that this is not a concern for me in terms of speaking about marriage equality. Finally, I think it's important for us to really engage community in a way that is respectful, that in a way also recognize the differences that we have. And it's a reminder that community organizing is something that takes a long time, and it isn't over in an election cycle.
I've heard it said that what this proves is that in the African-American community, and even among African-American LGBT people, evidently marriage equality isn't our issue, that there are other things that are more important. And I'm sure that's true for some people. It's also true for many white LGBT people, that this is not their issue. The other thing I know is that there is a very strong African-American marriage equality movement that has been going on for years. There certainly are people who are well positioned to go into their communities on Prop 8. And I don't think we should forget that same-sex couples are not the only people who have been prohibited from marrying in this country. I mean, that's the classic thing that happened to slaves. You know, there was no legal marriage for slaves. There was no legal marriage for interracial couples until very recently in this country. So we need to not discount the experience of not only African Americans, but other people of color on the importance of marriage equality. If you look at in the Hispanic community, for instance, one of the nice special little benefits that you get from legal marriage is the right to bring your spouse from another country to live here, to have legal status. Those folks, you know, folks who live in communities of immigrants understand what it means when same-sex couples can't bring their spouse here. There are natural alliances that not only can be followed up, but that exist. The question is, do the people with that experience and that knowledge rise to the place where they can make the organizing decisions about where the resources go, about who is going to be speaking for a community, who's going to be organizing, so that it becomes an organic, the community organizing itself, rather than outside people saying, oh, right, that constituency is going to be important, so we're going to send our people in there and organize them.
Again, this is Cecil Prescott from Love Makes a Family.
The fallback position for the most conservative voices in all communities is something called civil union or domestic partnership. And when you explore and ask them what it means and ask them about, you know, does it mean that you can visit in the hospital and stuff like that? And they said, sure, of course. And then you ask a bit more details about financial family security, and people say, of course. And, you know, their civil union domestic partnership begins to look a whole lot like marriage, but without the word. So just hold on to that for a while. And then recognize that even the discussion about marriage is relatively new for most Americans. Love Makes a Family has been doing this for, you know, 20 years, and so this is old hat for us. 10 years ago, when the Hawaiian Supreme Court decision came out, and That was just the beginning that some people had an idea of what that was. We had to do a whole lot of education in the mainstream LGBT community about why that's an important issue for this community. We have a whole lot more education to do in the wider community why marriage equality is important for all of us. And for people in California and people here in Oregon, we have a long way to go, but we've come a long way.
Bonnie Tinker from Love Makes a Family.
You know, I want to put one more thought in, which I'm just really started developing when you mentioned civil unions and domestic partnerships, because I've heard it raised many times, and logically, it makes sense. Okay, let's let the government do civil unions for everybody, or domestic partnerships for everybody, and the churches can do marriage, and then we'll have separation of church and state. And I have thought that seemed like a logical step, but it just recently occurred to me that I think that separation, real separation of church and state, may be more difficult for the general population in this country than same-sex marriages. And one thing I noticed, for instance, with Barack Obama, okay, this was crashing the glass ceiling on a number of fronts. I mean, not just being an African American, but being very upfront about being from a biracial family. On the other hand, I doubt very much if he could have been elected if he did not have a wife, but also if he could not have said, I am a Christian. It is an assumption that is so deeply embedded in this society that we don't even notice it, that this is a Christian government. And to ask people who are serious about their Christianity to let go of the religious impact on government, I think, may be harder than to ask them to let go of the idea that homosexuality itself is sinful.
Can you talk about organizing that Love Makes a Family does across race and class lines?
One thing that I'm really excited about Love Makes a Family, it's an organization that's been around for many, many years. But I think part of its longevity is its multi-issue organizing and analysis. Therefore, we are by nature an organization that seek to look at the whole picture, to have a deeper analysis, and therefore begin to ask, well, how do we organize in our communities around these very important issues? One thing that as I look back on the history of Love Makes a Family in terms of organizing is that we always see the issue of justice as very critical. And what does it mean to be an organization for justice? Now, not that it doesn't mean that you don't have conflict with what is your base in terms of what the base thinks it should be your critical issue on of the day. But I think we have done that long-term education of ourselves and our community that we're able to see those type of connections and therefore allow us to organize very creatively around various issues.
There was a time in Portland when our police chief, it was discovered, had made some anti-gay statements about people with AIDS long ago in his past, and the question was within the community, should he be challenged on this, or should we say, we got pretty good relationships going with the police department here. They're our friends. Let's not rock the boat here too much. And we went to the position that, no, he should be challenged, but he shouldn't just be challenged based on what he had said about gay men with AIDS. He should also be challenged on what he had said about corporal punishment of children. And the whole police department should be challenged based on the way other minority communities were being treated by the police department. So where we found allies in raising this issue was actually not so much in the LGBT organized community as it was going back to the community activists in the African American community, in Hispanic community, and among anarchists, young people who've been persecuted by the police, and pulling together forums there to talk about What do we expect of the police in terms of accountability to the community? Another thing that has been important for us, especially early on, one of our board members, Sherrianne Hager, was actually the staff person for the American Friends Service Committee's program working with minority young people and the schools. It was called the School Discipline Project because what was happening is racial minority students were being disciplined much more frequently than white students. They were being, you know, suspended, kicked out, everything across the board. And Sherrianne was an advocate for not only for students, but she taught parents how to advocate for their children. She's one of the founding members of Love Makes a Family. And she came in to teach LGBT parents how to become parent advocates. Because what we realized is that she had a whole well of knowledge that we needed, not only in terms of the logistics of how do you deal with a school system, but just in the mindset of being a minority parent in that school system. How do you come in with enough strength that you can advocate for your child?
What are the next steps in the fight for marriage equality and the fight for beyond marriage equality here in Oregon?
Well, if I could dare say, I think one of the first steps is one thing I'm trying to retrain myself, being officially a pacifist and believing in nonviolent action, is to let's remember we're in a struggle, but not necessarily a fight. So one thing we need to do is demilitarize our thinking and learn how we can, when we see someone as our opponent, how can we transform that relationship into people who share a common culture, a common heritage, a common government, a common community, and come together. You know, and I'm really pleased to see that this is happening now across the board in the movement. People are saying, we need to go talk to people. And, you know, we've been doing that a long time, but we're really thrilled that people now want to do that. And I guess what we have to say from Love Makes a Family is we've got some experience with that. We've got some ideas on that. You really can go out and talk to your cousin who is a Mormon, who is convinced that you are going straight to hell. And you can really have a discussion that will move us forward in terms of gaining rights, but that will deepen your relationship, that will deepen the things that unite our community.
I also think that in terms of next step, that we need to identify or examine where we fall short. And one area is the difficulties we have to not only talk to our cousin who's opposed to marriage equality, but also our inability to reach communities that are different than ourselves. We are all aware how comfortable it is to live in our own bubble, where we feel affirmed and safe, and that's critical in terms of personal and social survival. But I think part of the reason why we do what we do is because of a vision we have of a larger society and a larger community that is inclusive of many different people and different ways of thinking, and that is part of the hard work. But as long as we recognize that vision we have of a totally inclusive community and recognize that that is very difficult work, that we have to find ways to, as Bonnie reminds us, to demilitarize our language and our action, but find ways in which we can build a larger, stronger, more inclusive community.
Practically speaking, in Oregon, we have a little constitutional amendment that says marriage is between one man and one woman. And we are going to have to overturn that. We are going to have to vote that out. So the first thing to do is to just be clear in our vision. We want full equality. And for me, that goes both ways. We also have a domestic partnership law now, which discriminates based on sex, gender, and sexual orientation. it is for same-sex couples only. If we want equality, we have to say, no, no fair. That needs to be open to everybody. Marriage needs to be open to everybody. We're going for equality here. And the first step in doing that is to believe that it's possible. And I think that's where, when we say examine our past here and what we've done, one of the worst things that happens to LGBT people from closeting is we become afraid. And we lose touch and we lose faith in people who are in those fabled opposite sex legal marriages, who are, you know, living the happy life, we think. We lose faith in them. What we need to remember is that people can change. They do change. And this was so important for me with Quakers, which is where I came from. We have to be at not only 51%. We work by unity, which means you got to get the whole ball of wax. And I have seen that happen with very biblically based heterosexual people. They can change. So for some people, it may seem impossible that a majority of people would vote to give us equal rights. But one thing Martin Luther King said is, sometimes we simply have to do the impossible because that's the only realistic choice. And I think we can do that.
That was Bonnie Tinker and Cecil Prescott from Love Makes a Family. For more information and to get involved with Love Makes a Family, email info@lmfamily.org or call 503-228-3892.
Information on Basic Rights Oregon can be found at www.basicrights.org, and you can phone them at 503-222-6151.
We love KBOO.
You've been listening to Circle A Radio. Circle A Radio airs the first and third Wednesdays of each month here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. To listen to or download this show, or to listen to some of our past programs, go to www.kbo.fm/Circle A Radio. We can also be contacted through that website.
Our next show will air December 17th, and we will celebrate the life and mourn our loss of Stubbs Terkel. Thanks for listening.
Good night.